housing market?
I think that it's always difficult to forecast the housing market, and I certainly don't think that I can give a good job of that today, but it will be interesting to see how it evolves in the years ahead.
Okay, well, it certainly won't be boosting people's confidence in terms of taking out loans and so on, I guess. But that is B. Boileau, the research economist at the IFS. It looks like we are going to have to wait a bit to see what the government's going to do, particularly on those supply-side planning restraints. That is it from us today. We're going to be going into the news in a moment. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Next on Times Radio, it is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Trevor, and good afternoon. I wasn't supposed to speak then, you were. Why don't you say it all again? Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Your turn now. Right. The AA is being fined £4 million over hidden fees for learner drivers. We'll hear from the AA and some slightly disgruntled driving instructors. We'll go through this week's Prime Minister's questions today in the company of Sir Mark Lyle Grant, a former National Security Advisor. What are Harry and Meghan up to down under? We'll talk to the Times Royal Editor Kate Mansey. We'll discuss the build-up to the Men's World Cup up in the US and in Mexico over the summer in the company of Jill Scott, the Lioness and Euros winner, and the star of Riot Women, The Thick of It and Getting On, Joanna Scanlon, is our big guest after 3:30.
And all of that happens after the news from Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. So Keir Starmer insists he isn't going to yield to Donald Trump's threats after he told Sky News a trade deal signed last year could change. The US president added the so-called special relationship with the UK is in a sad state as both men disagree over the Iran war. During Prime Minister's questions, Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey suggested this month's state visit to America should be put on hold.
Surely the Prime Minister can't send our king to meet a man who treats our country like a mafia boss running a protection racket.
The monarchy is an important reminder of the long-standing bonds and enduring relationship between our two countries.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister failed to answer Kemi Badenoch when she asked when a review on defence spending promised for the autumn would eventually be published after months of delay. It's after former Labour Minister and NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson claimed the Prime Minister had a corrosive complacency towards defence and was spending too much on welfare. The Prime Minister rejected the claim and turned the question back on the Conservatives.
When they came into office, defence spending was 2.5%. Yeah. When they left, it was 2.3%. When they came into office, the army was 100,000. When they left office, 72,000. She said at the weekend, our defence is the weakest for 400 years. That is what they left behind.
Elsewhere, the NHS is failing women, according to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, as he announced plans to make referrals for women's health concerns quicker and more streamlined and encourage professionals to listen to women more. He's pledged to link funding with positive feedback from women and cut areas that don't listen to women who've had bad care. Former chair of the Royal College of GPs, Baroness Gerada, who's been a GP for 40 years, told Times Radio some examples of medical misogyny she's come across.
If a woman presents with chest pain, for example, they're thought to have anxiety. If a man presents with chest pain, he's immediately referred for possible heart disease. So we also know, for example, that research is done predominantly on male illnesses with men. Women are excluded for actually being participants in research because maybe they're pregnant, but the evidence shows that they, in most cases, they don't need to be excluded.
The AA Motoring Group has been fined £4.2 million in order to repay £760,000 to customers after the competition regulator found its driving schools guilty of drip pricing. The Competition and Markets Authority found that more than 80,000 learner drivers were not shown the total price up front when booking lessons online, as required by law. Instead, a mandatory £3 fee was included later in the process. Around 85,000 UK households are to receive safety visits because of fire concerns over their tumble dryers. The Office for Product Safety and Standards says it affects models sold under brands including Hire, Candy and Lamona. And the body of an ultramarathon champion and former Royal Marine has been found on what is considered Britain's toughest run. David Parrish was trying to beat the record for the Highlands 234-mile Cape Wrath Trail. He was running the route to fundraise for Scottish Mountain Rescue in memory of a close friend. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thank you very much, Will. We have made it to Wednesday. Jane and I are here until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are packed as ever with some quite random news stories and some essential news stories. Jill Scott is in Texas having a blast ahead of the Men's World Cup. She's been seeing all of the sights. Jane, she has been to her first rodeo.
Oh, has she?
Yes.
Did she enjoy it?
So we talk about, this is not my first rodeo, but it was
actually
her first
was,
rodeo.
Yeah.
And we also talk about hair pulling and lots of other things. Harry and Meghan are down under. They're doing a tour of Australia. But why? We're going to talk to the Times' Royal Editor, Kate Manzi, about appearances on MasterChef. That's what Meghan is up to, and hand-holding at bedsides. Top telly back in the UK with our favourite Scott Bryan. We're also going to talk about driving lessons and how the AA has got into trouble with a £3 booking fee. If you paid that fee, then you are going to get it refunded. I'll be slamming the dashboard at just after 3:05 for that one. Sport, we will talk with Vassos about...
Well, we could just talk... we could call the item Wasting Time with Vassos Alexander, but that sounds
cruel.
A bit insulting, doesn't it? It's about the fact that Premier League games are getting longer and longer because there's so much time wasting.
Yeah.
But we'll also discuss something that David Wilkie, the champion swimmer's son, is attempting to do. He's in his 30s, not really a swimmer, not that fond of water even, and he's going to try and recreate his dad's gold medal winning time for the breaststroke.
Well, that's amazing. It must be quite weird if your dad is an Olympic swimmer. You know, when you go on your family holidays and everyone's just mucking about in the pool. Mm. Yeah, there'd be a competitive element to
that. I think
there
really would be.
Our big guest after 3:30 is everybody's favourite, Jane.
Actor Joanna Scanlon. A good writer too. She was one of the women who wrote or co-wrote Getting On, which is one of my favourite NHS-based sitcoms. I don't think it's available on the old iPlayer anymore, but it was there for a while. It kind of comes and goes. But you liked her show...
No Offence.
No Offence.
And Sir Trevor Phillips likes it too.
He does like it. But she has got a number of projects on the go at the moment. She was actually most recently in Riot Women, which people loved, the Sally Wainwright show about the menopausal punky band. And she learned the piano to take part in that. But she's got two things out and about at the moment. One is Missed Call, which is a very glossy Channel 5 drama. I think the popular term is it's stripped across the week at 9 o'clock on Channel 5. And you do want to know what happens. Joanna was very funny about, shall we say, some of the budget constraints that working sometimes for Channel 5 puts upon you. But I'm not sure that whether that made the interview. So perhaps
but that's the bit that we all want to hear now.
Everybody wants to hear about. But it's an interesting show. And also, she's recorded a book or an essay or a monologue, I'm not quite sure, or a drama, by the Guardian journalist Peter Bradshaw has written this thing called Mercy, in which Joanna Scanlon is back on the wards, in fact, as a nurse about to retire. And shall we say she spills some of her career beans, and it's very unsettling.
But well, that sounds intriguing.
Incredibly good. Yeah. Shall I do the most read stories on the Times website so far today as you prepare for our first item? In at number three, will jet fuel shortages ruin your summer holiday? The Times' brilliant travel team assessed the situation. The second most read story, Labour MP wants to take adult toys into Parliament for summer of sex. This is Samantha Niblett, the MP for South Derbyshire. She's launched her Yes, Sex, Please, We're British campaign before a debate on lifelong sex education in the Commons in the early autumn. And the most read piece on the Times website, Iran war latest. It is the live page. Trump threatens UK trade deal after lack of support. The live page is the place to go to get all of the latest lines on the Iran war. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
And the number to make contact with us in the studio this afternoon is 0333 003 2353. We're here with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Now, the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition have clashed over defence at today's session of Prime Minister's Questions. Here is Kemi Badenoch, the Tory leader, challenging Sir Keir Starmer repeatedly over spending.
Lord Robertson, who authored the government's strategic defence review, has said the Prime Minister has a corrosive complacency when it comes to defence. Why did he say that?
Mr Speaker, let me start by saying I respect Lord Robertson. And I thank him again. I thank him again for carrying out the strategic review. My responsibility is to keep the British people safe, and that is a duty I take seriously. That is why I don't agree with his comments. Last February, that was 7 months after taking office, I took the decision to increase defence spending from 2.3 to 2.6%, paid for by a difficult decision on overseas aid. Last June, at the NATO summit, I committed to raising core defence spending to 3.5%. Last November, Mr Speaker, the budget committed record funding to defence. I reaffirm those commitments now. The spending, the Strategic Defence Review is a 10-year blueprint for national security. The Defence Investment Plan will put that into effect. It will be published as soon as possible. We need to get it right. We inherited plans that were uncosted and undeliverable, and we're not going to repeat those mistakes.
There we are, the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, challenging Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer today. Let's have a word with Sir Mark Lyall-Grant, former British diplomat who has served as National Security Advisor. Sir Mark, good afternoon to you. What did you think of this session of PMQs?
Well, it was certainly dominated by defence spending, as you say. And I think George Robertson's comments yesterday gave a bit of an open goal to Kemi Badenoch to have a go at the government's response to the Strategic Defence Review. And I think George Robertson's comments were particularly wounding or damaging for the government because, of course, he is a former Labour politician, former Secretary General of NATO, and he was the leader of the government's Strategic Defence Review. So his words obviously carry a lot of weight. And I think what's also must be slightly embarrassing for the government is that he focused on we cannot continue to fund the welfare budget and keep Britain safe at the same time. And that goes to the heart of a huge debate within the governing party, within the Labour Party, about welfare reform. So Kemi Badenoch obviously focused on this and particularly attacked, I think, Keir Starmer on the delay in the publication of the Defence Investment Plan. This is the key document which will set out how the recommendations, the 62 recommendations of the SDR, will actually be funded and where the money will be spent in the future. And that was promised last year and still hasn't been published. And Keir Starmer sort of ducked and dived a bit by saying it would be sent as would be published as soon as possible, which means possibly not, you know, in this session of Parliament.
Right. So we can probably forget about that, at least in the short term. The problem for the Tories is when they criticise, in this case, the Labour government for defence spending, what they perceive to be a lack of interest in the subject. Sir Keir Starmer is entirely right in just batting it back and saying, well, frankly, you were useless.
Yeah, that was absolutely the centrepiece of Keir Starmer's defence, that actually the Conservatives, when they were in power, had reduced the size of the army from 100,000 to 72,000, had reduced the GDP spent on defence from 2.5 to 2.3. And so it ill behoved them to complain about the lack of defence spending. That was absolutely part of his defence, and it's a legitimate argument. But, you know, the longer you get into the Labour government, the less telling that sort of argument is.
Let's just have a listen to another exchange between the two. This is Kemi Badenoch having another go at Sir Keir Starmer.
Talking about an increase is not the same as giving an increase. The military and the defence industry want to hear about what he's going to do, not him prosecuting past governments. He promised the defence investment plan would be published. He promised that the defence investment plan would be published last autumn. I asked him at PMQs 6 weeks ago when it would be published. He had no idea. It is now the middle of April. What's the hold-up?
Minister. Mr. Speaker, I've set out my position. The defence investment plan is the first line-by-line review of defence budgets for 18 years. She talks about talking. If you're going to support and make your country safe, you have to get the right calls on the big issues. She called for us to jump into the war. They could pretend otherwise. I remember walking in, standing here for the first time, saying we would not get drawn into the war, we would not join the offensive, and they all shouted, shame. They remember it. I remember it. They're just embarrassed by it now.
I mean, that's a fairly typical exchange between the two of them, actually. And there was a bit of discussion there about the defence investment plan, which you referenced earlier, Sir Mark. But what about the idea that at one point today during PMQs, the Speaker had to intervene, actually, and just say to the Prime Minister, will you just answer the question? There's so much politicking and very little genuine information exchanged here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's become rather typical of Prime Minister's questions in recent years, to be honest. But I think, you know, it is a good point that Kemi Badenoch makes about the delay in the investment plan. And it's fair enough for Keir Starmer to sort of fall back on the defence that, well, we inherited a terrible position from the Conservatives. But I think what we saw in that particular exchange was Keir Starmer reprising the fact that he feels he's had a good war, as it were, by standing up to President Trump and not acceding to his request to get directly involved in offensive military action against Iran, and contrasting that with Kemi Badenoch, who at the initial phase of the conflict, at least, was seemed to be more encouraged and more gung-ho about Britain getting involved alongside the Americans. And so I think Keir Starmer was trying to just remind MPs, particularly in his own party, of how the fact that he stood up to President Trump. And that's why I think the Speaker intervened and said, look, hang on a sec, you're supposed to be answering questions, not just talking about where the leader of the opposition has been.
I think it's just worth saying that we have heard from President Trump in the last couple of hours. He has inevitably posted on Truth Social, and he says, and I'm quoting here, China is very happy that I'm permanently opening the Strait of Hormuz. I'm doing it for them also and the world. This situation will never happen again. They've agreed not to send weapons to Iran. President Xi will give me a big fat hug when I get there in a few weeks. We're working together smartly and very well. Doesn't that beat fighting? Not that long ago, Sir Mark, we'd have been absolutely amazed that an American president would have made any kind of statement of that nature. Has there ever been a time to be a time more nerve-jangling to be British Prime Minister than right now with this gentleman occupying the White House?
No, I don't think there ever has been. I mean, the manner in which President Trump's makes policy is completely unprecedented. And the manner of his sort of off the cuff, informal press conferences, telephone calls to journalists, Truth Social tweets in the middle of the night, etc. We've never seen this before. And it must be very unnerving for all political leaders. It's not just Keir Starmer who's in his sights at the moment. Even Giorgia Meloni, who was the sort of darling Trump whisperer a few months ago, is now being attacked as a result of his spat with the Pope. And every other Macron, all the other leaders have come under this sort of criticism from President Trump. And I think Keir Starmer you know, deserves some credit for the way he has managed to handle President Trump over the last 12, 14 months or so. I mean, I don't think it's a surprise that there is this clash of personalities and indeed big differences of opinion between the United Kingdom and President Trump's administration. That was absolutely to be expected, given that, you know, President Trump is a multi-billionaire property developer and Keir Starmer's an ex-human rights lawyer, etc. I think that the surprising thing to me is that for at least a year, it looked as though the relationship between the two was pretty good. But I think we're now reverting to what most people would have expected between a Labour government in London and a sort of MAGA president in the White House. But it must be very difficult to handle on a day-to-day basis. And I do feel some sympathy for Keir Starmer in this respect.
Yeah. I mean, do you think he actually gains anything? And we've got the local elections coming up in a couple of weeks and lots of people are saying, oh, well, Labour are going to about absolutely be destroyed. So for all the kudos he is getting, and some would say rightly from many quarters for attempting at least to stand up to Donald Trump, do you think the general public cares very much?
No, I don't. I mean, I think they probably do care, but I don't think they're going to affect their vote as a result of the relationship between the UK and the US. It is a fundamental relationship. And this is an important point that Keir Starmer makes. And this is perhaps relevant to what Ed Davey was saying in Prime Minister's Questions, where he has once again called for the King not to go on a state visit later this month to the United States. And Keir Starmer made the point that, look, even if there's a fractious political relationship at the top, the relationship between the two countries is a bit like an iceberg. You know, 7/8 of it is beneath the surface, and it's absolutely critical to Britain's national security and indeed prosperity. And therefore, irrespective of who happens to be in the White House or indeed in 10 Downing Street at any one time, the relationship between the two countries transcends that in a very meaningful and important way for Britain. And the King is able to sort of represent that wider UK interest. And I think it's therefore absolutely right that he is going ahead with that state visit. And I think Ed Davies is wrong to be sort of exploiting the fact that many British people really don't like President Trump and find his approach distasteful, by sort of jumping on that bandwagon and saying, well, the King shouldn't go. Because, as I say, the wider relationship goes much deeper than just that political froth on the surface.
Thank you very much. That is Sir Mark Lyall-Grant. Ed Davey referred today to President Trump as a man who treats our country like a mafia boss running a protection racket.
There's a fantastic piece in the Times today by David Charter in Washington about all of the posting that Donald Trump is doing at the moment, because some of it, the overnight stuff, does mark a slight difference in his usual pattern of behaviour, if indeed there is one, Jane. And he tells us so much fantastic detail. David Charter says, during the day, Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, keeps a live stream of his Truth social site on a monitor in her office along the West Wing corridor of power. She can engineer a distraction to divert him from going on a spree if necessary. There's a large vertical video monitor to the left of the fireplace in Susie's office, and it's a live feed of Trump's Truth Social post, says Chris Whipple, who interviewed Wiles at length for Vanity Fair. I think it's just a way for her to keep up with it, because nobody tries to control his Truth Social postings. And David Charter goes on to detail the unusual patterns, so particularly the posting at 2:35 a.m. to 2:38 a.m. and then at 4:10 a.m. on Monday morning. So the guy really did have no sleep at all. Those were the great big banging things that followed the AI image of him as Jesus. But details that we might have forgotten: there was a focus on Trump's posting hours in his first term after the 12:06 a.m. post, despite the constant negative press covfefe. That happened in May 2017. Do you remember that,
yeah,
one?
Yeah, because it was covfefe spelt with a C-E-F-F.
It certainly was. Trump, never one to admit fault, deleted that one 6 hours later and posted, "Who can figure out the true meaning of covfefe?" He once posted 158 Truth Socials between 9 p.m. and midnight on December 1st.
Gosh.
He's not sleeping a lot, is he?
Susie's not with him overnight, then.
She's not.
Where's Melania?
Well, Melania, David Charter tells us in the article as well, quite frequently when she's in town will have dinner with Donald, but then they do retire to their separate sleeping quarters.
So they have a quarter pounder. And then...
And fries.
Then they part ways.
Probably.
Gosh, romance isn't dead, is it?
Well, it's not. And obviously with the McDonald's, you have to wait quite a long time for the apple pie to cool, don't you, before eating it. So they're off to their own separate environments. That's quite enough from us. We're going to talk about Jill Scott's first rodeo in a few minutes' time. You're listening to Jane and Fee. It's 23 minutes past two.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, we're less than 2 months away from the Men's Football World Cup in the US, Canada and Mexico. Scotland kick off their campaign against Haiti in Massachusetts, while England begin against Croatia in Texas. Former Lioness Jill Scott is in the US state and knows what it takes to win after playing a key role in England's Euro 2022 triumph. She's been telling me what she has been getting up to in Texas.
So I'm actually in Texas because the Men's World Cup starts quite soon. England's first game is June the 17th, and I am actually travelling around having a bit of a fan experience, and I've had a great time so far. We started in Fort Worth and I went to my first rodeo. I learned to do some line dancing, and then I even went and stayed at Wildcatter Ranch for one night where I went for a horse ride with the sunset and everything. So, yeah, I'm just having a great time travelling around Texas.
When you went to the rodeo, if it was your first rodeo, did you actually stand there and say, this is my first rodeo?
I did actually turn around and say that, but wow, it's such an amazing event. The skill levels to try and stay on the bull is just another level, but it's a great time, and you could see so many groups of people just going there really for a good night, and hopefully when fans arrive in Texas, they'll be able to do that and really make kind of like a good holiday day out of everything. Now that I've been retired nearly 4 years, I count myself as a fan, so I can take part in things. I was even with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders learning a routine yesterday. So yeah, I'm definitely not going to be a cheerleader anytime soon.
Right, okay. Have you not? Well, you must have the coordination, Jill. We've seen that you've got the coordination.
My legs were okay, but then when you have to try and include your arms, it got a little bit tricky, I'm not going to lie.
Right. What will the England players be feeling right now with only weeks to go?
Yeah, I think for them, they'll be focusing on their club games. A lot of them are coming to kind of the business end of the season. They're going for league titles. They'll be involved in cup matches as well. So I think that'll be the focus. But they'll definitely have a little bit of an eye on the World Cup coming up, because they'll be so excited to obviously head out here and play against some of the best teams in the world. So, yeah, I think it'll be about trying to stay fit. I know a lot of them, you don't want to get injured at this part of the season, and hopefully they won't, and hopefully we can have a fully fit England team here in America.
A lot of people are a little bit fearful of what's coming out of America at the moment in terms of the politics, Jill. And I wonder whether you've got any thoughts about that. I mean, I hear you when you say you're having a fantastic time in Texas. But actually, you know, a lot of the images that we've seen about immigration raids in other parts of the country, some in Texas too, they would be in people's minds when they're traveling to America, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to talk about politics. I can probably only talk about my experience here and the last 4 days, as I say, traveling around and trying different events and kind of seeing Texas getting so excited for this tournament. I think they've definitely thought that people aren't going to have tickets for every single game because it's probably not something that you can do, but there's going to be fan zones, there's going to be watch-along parties, and I think anybody that's heading out here, as I say, I can only talk about my experience, but I do think it'll be a trip of a lifetime.
Do you think it will be a tournament that could change the way Americans feel about soccer? So when you've been travelling around, you know, have you found that people have recognised you, that they're really into the women's game as well? How do you measure it?
Yeah, I think for me, the women's game out here has always been absolutely flying. Whenever I played for England, USA were always the team to beat. And I think it's always kind of been something that they do take seriously. I think a lot of Americans do follow the Premier League. I was in a shop the other day and there was a couple of guys come over and they said that they listened to one of the podcasts that I do. So, yeah, it was nice to speak to local people. And I must say, everybody's been really friendly as well. So, yeah, I'm not getting used to calling it soccer. It's still football to me. But
yeah, please don't call it soccer.
Love for the sport here.
Yeah. What about your own future, Jill? I mean, I know that you have said in the past, haven't you, that you wouldn't be interested in the coaching positions. Has that changed at all now?
No, I've always said that I love coaching, and I always said that when I finished playing, I did think that was kind of the route that I was going to go down. But I found myself in the jungle suddenly on I'm a Celebrity. And I think, yeah, I've got to do some amazing things over the years. I'm not somebody that really plans ahead too much. I'm a big believer in just work hard and enjoy what you're doing and then see what tomorrow brings. So, yeah, I feel very, very lucky to be doing what I'm doing. Obviously, I'm out here in Texas having a fan experience talking about football, and I just feel super, super lucky. So yeah, who knows what the future will hold, but hopefully it'll be something that brings a big smile to my face.
Will it include coaching though, do you think?
Yeah, it could do. I've been getting a little bit back on the grass recently, doing a couple of coaching sessions, and I love it. I'm so happy when I'm out there and I've got a ball at my feet. So yeah, might in the future.
I can't let you go, Jill, without talking about hair pulling, because we've talked about it quite a bit on the programme over the last couple of weeks, and so much was made of what happened at the Manchester United Leeds match between Martinez and Dominic Calvert-Lewin, and it has happened in the women's game as well. There's been a strange kind of conversation about women's hair in sport as a result of it, and I wonder what you think of it all.
Well, I've got long hair and I actually never got it pulled in all the time that I played football. So I know there has been a few incidents over the year. I think if it's done in an aggressive manner, then yeah, it definitely should be penalised. I did see the Man United one. There's an argument that did he aggressively pull his hair? I'm not too sure, but yeah, I must say that it's something that crops up, pardon the pun, now and then. But I don't think it's something that we're seeing in the game all the time.
It was a good pun. That was Jill Scott talking about her exciting trip to Texas.
Thank you for bringing us that. Now, next, we're going to go down under and discuss the semi. Well, what is it? It's not really a royal visit. It's a visitation by a former royal and his partner to Australia. It's Harry and Meghan on tour, and who better to analyse exactly what they're up to
than the Times Royal Editor, Kate Mansey. She's with us next on Times Radio. After the headlines, Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Sir Keir Starmer's hit back at claims the government isn't investing enough in defence. Former NATO chief Lord Robertson says ministers are complacent and spending too much on welfare. The Prime Minister told the Commons he's delivering the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War, reversing Conservative cuts. But Kemi Badenoch says he still needs to explain when the new money will actually arrive.
Talking about an increase is not the same as giving an increase. The military and the defence industry want to hear about what he's going to do, not him prosecuting past governments. He promised that the defence investment plan would be published last autumn. I asked him at PMQs 6 weeks ago when it would be published. He had no idea.
An investigation's underway after bottles suspected to be carrying petrol and bricks were thrown at a synagogue in North London. Police say two suspects wearing dark clothes and balaclavas approached the site in Finchley shortly after midnight. They're treating the incident as an anti-Semitic hate crime. The Health Secretary's pledged to tackle what he calls an appalling culture of medical misogyny in services across England. Wes Streeting says gynaecology waiting lists will fall faster than those in other parts of the NHS. John Healey's pledged to send the UK's biggest ever package of drones to Ukraine. He's meeting fellow defence secretaries in Berlin. And two men have been handed the first bans for trying to enter a football match in England and Wales without a ticket. They won't be allowed to go to a game for 3 years after being caught during last month's EFL Cup final at Wembley. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hi, Fee. Hi. So you saw a question time earlier on in the comments where Kemi Badenoch and the Tory party were piling into Keir Starmer, accusing him of just not doing his job, not doing enough or doing anything quickly enough to get British defences up to speed, up to strength, or doing it quickly enough. And those are fair points, because I think the Prime Minister and the government are in a corner. They're fair points that almost anyone is entitled to make, except the Tory party, after 14 years of letting British defences waste away in the way that they did, year after year. But I'm talking about the solid questions there, because there are plenty of them. And so I'm going to be talking to the Director of Military Sciences at RUSI. I'm going to be talking to Igor Novikov. He used to advise Volodymyr Zelensky. And that's interesting. Well, it will be, because you would have seen the story. There's just been a battle in Ukraine that was fought and won by Ukraine purely using drones and robots. I mean, no soldiers at all. There were no injuries or deaths on the Ukrainian side, but they took back the territory. First time that's happened in history. So Igor Novikov can talk about that, as also as a component of defence in the future. You know, sci-fi has arrived. And when it comes to spending, well, I'm going to be talking about that in some detail. You know, is there a way to have your cake and eat it? Because that's the way the government seem to be arguing at the moment. You can have a stronger defence without cutting other programmes. Well, can you? Yes. So let's talk about that. And also, I'm going to be looking at, well, it's a long list of things today, frankly. I'm going to talk to Louise Hague, the Labour soft left MP. Where does she and her wing of the party stand on some of these questions of spending trade-offs? I'm going to be talking to Martin Lewis, of course, the money guru, about, well, he's got a particular story about debt collecting and how a really, really brutal form of debt collecting is being reined in by the government. But he can also have his say, of course, on the cost of living and what needs to be done about that.
Lovely stuff, John. Thank you very much. John takes over from us between 4 and 7 here on Times Radio.
Now, we hope to talk to Kate Mansey, our royal editor, in a moment or two. First, over the weekend, Donald Trump posted an image of himself as Jesus, a Jesus-like figure. It was subsequently deleted, and it came after the president and the Pope had had a war of words over the conflict in Iran. Donald Trump has been engaging in a verbal battle with Pope Leo over the Pope's words on the war in Iran. On today's episode of the story, Democratic operative and Pope Leo watcher Christopher Hale spoke to Manveen Rana about the views of Christians towards the war.
I think it's really important to note that the religious right in this country is really divided in two capacities. There are MAGA Catholics and MAGA evangelicals. The biggest distinction policy-wise between these two groups is the question of war. MAGA Catholics are much more skeptical of war. They're much more skeptical of this war in Iran, and they don't have the support for the state of Israel as a core component of their identity. To be an evangelical in the United States is to have support for the state of Israel to be almost a biblical belief, and that is not the case among MAGA Catholics. So what we've seen in the past 24 to 48 hours is that MAGA evangelicals are standing with President Trump oftentimes on his tweet attacking Pope Leo XIV. But they're upset about that second tweet you mentioned where Donald Trump depicts himself as Jesus Christ. And I think this is really important to note. Only one of those tweets did the president delete. It was the one that upset evangelicals.
And you've obviously represented the Democratic Party. You've sort of appealed for Catholic votes in the past. Give us a sense of context, though, sort of in terms of the breakdown of votes. What percentage of Catholics in America tend to vote, have been voting for Donald Trump?
From about 1960, when modern polling began, till about 2012, it was really a 50-50 reality. It's become back and forth since then, but President Trump won a significant portion of the Catholic vote in 2024, likely double digits from most of the polling and exit surveys we saw. That's been fueled by a higher percentage of vote among brown and black Catholics, which was what mirrored the general population. However, we've seen a significant drop domestically in Catholic support for the president. I would say that most of the polling shows that this drop in support among Catholics is higher than the drop of support among the general population. And once again, it's because of the brown and black communities. There has been a big bleeding of support, and I think the ICE deportation raids really precipitated that. However, I think with the Iran war, you're going to start seeing more bleeding among white Catholics as well.
That is the voice of Christopher Hale. He is a Democrat and author of the Letters from Leo Substack. He was talking there to Manveen Rana on the Story podcast. You'll know that that's one story told in depth every day. It's available completely for free wherever you get your podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Now, Scott Bryan, our TV critic chum, will be with us before 3 o'clock to talk about the best telly around at the moment. He's a big fan of the Other Bennett Girl, or is the Other Bennett Sister? Which, what is the name of that show? Have you watched it?
No.
Thanks, Pete.
So I can be of absolutely no help.
It's the Other Bennett Sister. So we'll talk about that. I've seen it, and I know Scott absolutely loves it. I confess I thought it was all right, but not as good as he thinks it is. Right. Anyway, I'll talk about that. Also, actually, some big news from the BBC today, and Scott will talk about this too. They're cutting 1 in 10 jobs. Which is obviously not good news for people who work there. So I think they were being told about it today. So it's often the way that news about the BBC is broadcast by other institutions before the BBC itself gets around to doing it.
Well, if anybody at the BBC has heard that news via us, I think we do send our deepest condolences. So that's 2,000 people losing their jobs. More to follow,
isn't it? Yeah. Okay, let's talk royals. Harry and Meghan are in Australia. They're on a kind of semi-official tour. Harry told an event in Melbourne that he wasn't pointing the finger at his own parents, but he wants to improve as a father to his own children. He says every generation needs to improve on the way they were brought up. Now, the couple are attending a variety of charity and corporate events. Meghan's also making a TV appearance.
We've had MasterChef royalty in the kitchen before, but no one like this. All the way from sunny California, please welcome to the MasterChef Australia kitchen, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle!
Still using the title there then, it would seem. What is going on? What are they up to? Well, we did hope to speak to Kate Mansey. That's not been possible, but we have got an excellent replacement. It's only royal historian Tessa Dunlop. Hello, Tessa, how are you?
If we're talking about titles, Jane, it'll be Dr. Tessa Dunlop to you.
Sorry. Hang on. Let me just stay quiet and we'll do the whole thing again. Who needs Kate Mansey when you've got a doctor in the house? Dr. Tessa Dunlop, royal historian. Hello, Tessa. How are you?
Hello. I was interested to note there that you focused on her title, the Duchess, because actually I thought they made quite a big point when they touched down. Was it Melbourne or Canberra? I can't remember where they first arrived. And she said, just call me Meg. And Harry said, you can refer to me as any old thing. I answer to hi or any old cry, words to that effect. Obviously, they'd learnt from the sort of drubbing she got at the back end of last year that these ceremonial introductions didn't go down too well. And of course, there is an affection down under in some parts of Australia for the royal family. And I think they've been quite carefully curated the way in which they've not kind of upscaled their royal identity for fear of, I think, somehow triggering that more conventional royalist sentiment in Australia and for fear of being accused of aping their very successful 2018 tour.
What are they actually up to? I mean, this is about, look, I'm not knocking it because we all have to make a living. This is about them earning some Australian dollar, isn't it?
Well, I think that there's a combination of things going on here. They're honest now, aren't they, that they've got to earn a considerable crust. Meghan likes positioning herself as a successful businesswoman. She has taken or did take most of Wednesday off for business meetings, which, of course, infuriated the press because no one really knew where she was. And that lent into Harry being able to bod about mansplaining about mental health and catching the odd cylindrical shaped ball and reminding us of why he was last year, I think, criticised for really being an individual best trained just to do charity work while his wife earned the money. And of course, that's ultimately what they've ended up doing. And fair play to Harry. I mean, he was only really trained to do one thing post-army, wasn't he? And that was glad hand and make everyone except the royal family feel good about themselves. And I think that's pretty much what he is doing at the moment.
Dr. Dunlop, thank you very much for helping us out. We do appreciate it, Tessa.
My pleasure.
Take care. Thank you. Kate Mansey's here now, royal editor of The Times. Now, Kate, this is one royal tour, but a much more significant event is due to happen at the end of April when the King goes to Washington. Do you think it's going to happen?
Is the King going to go to Washington? Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Right.
I mean, there's been lots of talk, hasn't there? Will it happen? Should it happen? And it's been controversial, you know, in the preceding weeks because people have said, well, this isn't a good time. It could be embarrassing for the King. Meanwhile, for 6 months, these plans have been in place with the palace and, you know, that in their mind, it's always been going ahead. Now, we now know more about what the King will do when he's out there. He'll go to Washington, D.C. There'll be a private tea with the Trumps, with Donald and Melania. There will be a state dinner at the White House. The King will use his address to Congress to talk about the challenges that the countries face together and with other allies. And then he'll go off to New York and he'll go to Virginia before flying on to Bermuda for a kind of something slightly different for 2 days.
OK, so at no point, I mean, presumably the idea is to minimise the possibility of embarrassment. So at no point will the King be in a hot mic situation with Donald Trump.
Well, the thing with the Donald Trump is that he's so unpredictable, but it seems from the itinerary and the schedule that's been laid out by the palace that there is kind of minimum risk of any embarrassment to the King during what's scheduled. So he'll go and meet Donald Trump at the Oval Office, but there isn't going to be that kind of hot mic moment where there'll be lots of reporters there, no one will be able to kind of fire questions at them. That said, in those few seconds that we have the photo call in the Oval Office, who's to say that Donald Trump won't turn around and look at the bust of Winston Churchill behind him and say, well, they don't make them like that anymore. We just don't know. But, I mean, everything seems to be very, very heavily choreographed to avoid any embarrassment to the King. Donald Trump will want to avoid any embarrassment to the King as well. He's very fond of the royal family, as we know. And the King will be going over there to to kind of reaffirm and renew that relationship, not just with this particular president, but with the American people more generally and, you know, between the two countries as head of state.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine if Donald Trump invited him to an all-night pyjama truth social party where they just rode the social media wave through the wee small hours. Can you imagine that?
That would be a great story, wouldn't it?
Well, it'd be terrifying. But I mean, as you say, not impossible, judging by the way the man rolls. So, Ed Davey, what was it he said today? Surely the PM can't send our king to meet a man who treats our country like a mafia boss running a protection racket. I think there are quite a few people who are quite sympathetic to the Lib Dem leader's stance on this, but you're absolutely certain it's going to go ahead.
Well, the palace say that the king is going on advice of the Foreign Office. When he speaks at the state dinner, when he speaks to Congress, he'll be speaking on, you know, on the advice of the government. And, you know, although there have been disagreements between Sir Keir Starmer and Donald Trump, that relationship between the countries, I think, is something they'll want to underline during this visit. There'll be other elements too. So he'll be going to New York. He'll be looking at the anniversary of 9/11. You know, there'll be other elements, you know, rather than just those kind of set piece moments, I suppose.
And the Epstein survivors, there will not be an encounter between any of them and any royal personage.
No, a Buckingham Palace official was very clear about that yesterday. The King and Queen feel completely unable to meet any Epstein survivors because they don't want to jeopardise any potential police inquiry going on here. That said, the Queen will be meeting advocacy groups from other who help other victims of domestic and sexual violence while she's over in the States. But I think Donald Trump and the King will both want to avoid any discussion of Jeffrey Epstein while the visit is taking place.
Yeah. OK, thank you very much. Understandable. Kate Mansey, thank you.
Thanks.
Sorry
Pleasure.
For the confusion earlier as well, but we're very glad you came. Thank you.
Now, Anne, very good afternoon to you. Anne, the other Bennett sister is a joyous delight and distraction in these grim Trump-fuelled times. Gorgeous. And what television was made for. Go on, Jane and Fee. Succumb to its pleasures.
Well, I tried.
You tried. Yeah. You couldn't carry on.
It's about to be a bit wishy-washy.
Yeah. Oh, good Lord. Mm. OK. Well, I haven't tried it at all, so I can't really criticise you for that. We will talk about it and also talk about these huge BBC job cuts as well with Scott Bryan in a couple of moments' time. It's 3:10.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So the BBC is going to cut 1 in 10 jobs in a major downsizing episode. Scott Bryan, our TV critic, is here. Hello, Scott.
Afternoon.
Do we know much more about which jobs are going to go?
Not yet, no, but we will know shortly. There's going to be a meeting in about 10 minutes, essentially a town hall. And I think a town hall under any sort of premise is always going to be creating a lot of nerves. If if that inbox invite ever comes into your inbox. I mean, I think that what has been clear is that the BBC in the last month has been clear that they are going to be making cutbacks. There's a 10% cut was tipped in the BBC annual plan, which is where they set out their plans for the year. And I think a lot of it is also to kind of to get the bad news out of the way before Matt Britton takes over as BBC Director General, which is understood to be at the end of next month. So set the ball rolling. But of course, very depressing news if you happen to be a BBC staff member after, of course, you know, many years of existing cuts. And of course, major questions about the future of BBC public service broadcasting if licence fee payers are no longer going to be paying for one and they've been leaving in apparently high numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC is by no means the only broadcasting organisation that's had to have a massive revamp because of the pressures of the digital world, actually. I know the BBC is different because it's funded by the public purse too, but actually some of the other broadcasting organisations do very big things indeed, don't they? And the BBC's always under pressure to do stuff like lose BBC Three or lose BBC Four or shut down some of the big networks. That's not what we're getting here, though. Is that the sense that you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think so far by early reports is that it's going to be around staff members rather than services. I mean, I think services will come into scope with Matt Britton coming over as Director General just purely because of his background working with Google. And them being, you know, very tech minded. I think a challenge the BBC has is its approach around universality, which is essentially that it has to be providing a service for everybody. Because if you cut BBC Three and BBC Four, which of course do not have high viewing figures because you assume, you know, everyone's watching it online, they would actually have quite a bit of resistance, not only you know, from people who would say that the shows would be out of the way, they would only be online, but also because a lot of lower income households don't have devices, really. And that makes it harder for them to access those services. And I think, you know, that's a challenge that every broadcaster is going to be facing is how can we essentially still have the same reach with the same amount of people, but also be tech minded and invest in our future? I mean, it's incredibly expensive to keep up existing services whilst providing for new ones too.
Yeah, well, we have our sympathy for those people who are going to be told that they're losing their jobs today. We will bring you news as soon as we get it, if a bit more information comes out of that town hall. Let's talk TV, though. The other Bennett sister, well, Anne absolutely loves it and has told us to watch it. Jane's watched a bit of it. She's not very impressed, and I haven't been drawn to it at all, Scott. Do you like it?
I am in the four camp. I mean, I normally find that period dramas, they're actually harder for me to get into just because, well, many reasons. I think it's the fact that they can feel quite stale or quite stodgy, or maybe it's set more for international American audiences who love period dramas. They could be financially lucrative, but a lot of the time you're wondering, well, what else is there new to it? And I think what I like about the other Bennett sister, sort of following Pride and Prejudice, but from the perspective of a different sister, is that firstly, the writing, I think, is really sharp, and I think the character is really sharp. It's about sort of finding love in an unconventional way. But I also just think that the female characters have quite a bit of autonomy. They're not all kind of written as one. And I think it's also the fact that it's got a great pacing. I mean, I've always been a firm believer shorter episodes can have a big impact rather than making you stretched out to a full hour. And I think the other Bennett sister really leans in on that.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to give it a go. Miriam Margolyes has been given the celebrity documentary treatment. I'm amazed it's taken this long. Now, this is about her household arrangements, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah, well, it's about a friendship that develops between the director, Simon Draper, and Miriam Margolyes. And then Miriam trying to launch a podcast and then failing because she can't really get the technology working half the time to actually launch a podcast. I mean, of course, Miriam Margolyes is a rarity, I think, in which she is known by every generation and I think loved by every generation. I mean, in the actual documentary, she reveals that she makes six figures from just making cameo videos, which is where you make videos for individual fans. And a lot of those fans skew younger. And what this does is that it's a documentary done by Simon, who admits at the start that he is just filming off the cuff, no plan, couldn't get a job in TV at that time because there were no jobs available. And it then becomes just like an intimate portrait between them two, really, and a friendship that then develops. And of course, when it's Miriam, you expect Miriamisms to develop quite quickly. So, you know, an abundance of farts, her being incredibly outspoken on absolutely everything. And also the gear shifts. And she's talking about helping a loved one who has had a diagnosis, and then talks about, I think, her bra size within the same breath. It's quite a transition, but that makes us all the love of all the more.
Where can we find this treat?
It's called Miriam Margolyes Made Me, and it's on BBC iPlayer.
Excellent. A quick missive about the inside story of the Artemis II mission. Now, that lands on our TVs tonight. This isn't just about what's happened over the last week or so. This is the long-term planning, isn't it?
It is, yeah, because, of course, Artemis is part of a wider sort of plan to get us back onto the moon and have a rolling base there. I mean, I like this one because it's on iPlayer. It's called To the Moon and Back. You can already watch it on iPlayer. And it just follows the astronauts from the very beginning, from when they're chosen, all of the training of them being out, of course, on space only just over a week ago. And I think it's the level of detail, because, of course, they are travelling when they re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, 32 times the speed of sound. Of course, there was a lot of issues with Artemis 1 in regards to the heat shield, so they look at the science behind that. It's done by the Horizon Strand, and they're very good at, I think, you know, not thinking that you're a bit thick, you know, actually explaining for science and doing it in detail, but not making it feel like you're being lectured to. It's an art. But I think it also shows about the excitement and thrill of going back to space again. You kind of understand what it must have been like back in the 1960s when we did it the first time, now that we're doing it again now.
I love that honesty. Horizon, not for thickos. Thank you very much. Scott Bryan is our TV critic. We were talking about Miriam Margolyes. We were talking about the inside story of the Artemis 2 mission, both available on the iPlayer, and the other Bennett sister as well.
Yeah, and later on, our guest after 3:30 is Joanna Scanlon, who's on Channel 5 at the moment in a thriller you might well be enjoying called Mist Call, set in a very steamy south of France. So Joanna spills some of her thespian beans after 3:30 this afternoon.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
3 o'clock, good afternoon, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock, when John Pienaar takes over. Now, in the next hour, the AA has been fined more than £4 million and ordered to refund tens of thousands of customers. Why? Vassos Alexander will bring us the sport. We're going to talk about Premier League time-wasting and the son of a British Olympian bidding to match his father's record-breaking time. And our big interview, as I've said, is with the actress and writer Joanna Scanlon. She of The Thick of It and Getting On and Riot Women and so much else. The news at 3 is read by Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer insists he isn't going to yield to Donald Trump's threats after the president told Sky News a trade deal signed last year could change.
A lot of pressure has been applied to me to take a different course, and that pressure included what happened last night. I'm not going to change my mind. I'm not going to yield. It is not in our national interest to join this war, and we will not do so. I know where I stand.
It's after the US president added the so-called special relationship with the UK is in a sad state, as both men disagree over the Iran war. This afternoon, Trump has said he would permanently open the Strait of Hormuz for China and the world. He's written that President Xi will give him a big fat hug when he gets to China in a few weeks. He claims China have agreed not to send weapons to Iran. The Prime Minister says he disagrees with the former Labour Minister and NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson that he has a corrosive complacency towards defence spending. The Chancellor's proposed increasing defence spending by less than £10 billion over the next 4 years, despite stark warnings that Britain's national security and safety is in peril. At PMQ's, Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch pressed Sir Keir Starmer over a defence spending review that has been delayed for months. The Prime Minister refused to engage with the question directly.
She called for us to jump into the war. She said this weekend, Mr. Speaker, that what she meant, she was talking about verbal support.
Prime Minister, it's Prime Minister's questions. We've got to concentrate. Kevin Bedford.
Times' chief political commentator Patrick Maguire was unsurprised by the PM's approach.
He's not responding to the actual question. He's saying you don't have a right to ask this question because of your cuts to defence. If he was saying, well, this is what's happening and then here's the context, which means it's not my fault, that's qualitatively different from what he started to do at PMQs. And as you and I heard from Chris Ward, one of his closest allies in this studio last year, Hugo, this is basically a deliberate strategy to say, this is my pulpit, this is my bully pulpit, I'm just going to make the political argument I want.
Attack.
The Speaker laying down the law there implies that maybe this strategy is not that long for this world.
Elsewhere, an investigation is underway after bottles suspected to be carrying petrol and bricks were thrown at a synagogue in North London. Police say two suspects wearing dark clothes and balaclavas approached the site in Finchley shortly after midnight. They're treating the incident as an anti-Semitic hate crime. A court has heard a film student was punched, kicked and stamped on by up to seven men before being fatally stabbed in London. 21-year-old Finbar Sullivan died at Primrose Hill last Tuesday. Four men have been remanded in custody in connection with his death. And one in 10 BBC staff will be told their jobs will be cut this afternoon. It's part of a £600 million cost-cutting plan announced in February. The broadcaster is to cut as many as 2,000 jobs in the biggest downsizing of the public service broadcaster in 15 years. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We've got plenty to tickle your fancy in the next hour of the programme. Joanna Scanlon is our big guest after 3:30, and we will talk about David Wilkie. I think he's such a big figure to people of a certain age, and that would include you and me, because his swimming just took this country's ability to shine in the pool to a different level, doesn't it?
He won a gold medal at the Olympics. And we didn't have that many gold medalists back
we
in the day.
We did not.
So when somebody did win big, for what we didn't call at the time, Team GB, it was great, huge news.
So we're going to talk about his legacy and the sporting achievement that his son is going for in about 20 minutes' time. But our next story may well affect you, or if you've got 17, 18, 19-year-olds learning to drive, it may have affected them. The AA has been fined more than £4 million over hidden driving lesson fees. The Competitions and Markets Authority has also ordered more than 80,000 customers be refunded, saying that the AA and BSM driving schools were guilty of what's called drip pricing. They both put a mandatory £3 fee at the end of the lesson booking process. Well, let's talk first of all to Carly Brookfield, who's CEO of the Driving Instructors Association. Carly, a very good afternoon from us. What's your response to this?
It's very disappointing. It's very shocking to hear that a national driving school has engaged in such practices. I notice they have put a statement out explaining their side of things, but the truth remains that the CMA has found them guilty of such practices as drip pricing. So for an industry that is, almost constantly trying to promote the value of investing in professional instruction, to find out that customers have been misled about pricing the sector is very, very disappointing.
We are going to talk to the president of the AA in a couple of moments' time, and I just say that so our listeners can rest assured that we will get all sides to the story that we possibly can. But can you just tell us a little bit more about what drip pricing is? What would we have seen if we were a customer trying to get through to one of your members, a driving instructor, through the AA or BSM driving schools?
They would have seen a quoted lesson price, and they would have expected that that was the price they would pay for either the single lesson or the block of lesson. But what appears to have happened in this case is that there are administration fees that AA maintains at some point they appraise customers of, but customers weren't, as far as the CMA, aware of what those extra charges would be at the time they committed to making a payment.
So the obvious thing as well is that when you book a driving lesson, you don't have very much to compare it to, do you? If it's your first time learning to drive, you don't really imagine what it is. You might have a rough idea of what it costs because a mate has told you or your parents have told you. But this is quite a kind of almost a naive market in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, most independent driving instructors and many franchise instructors as well will charge a lesson price that covers the cost of delivering that lesson, plus the value of their professionalism and professional expertise in guiding you safely through to driving test and beyond. Businesses charging administration fees are normally rolled up into the cost of that hourly lesson, and that's been the historical, you know, way of doing it in the driver training industry. Hidden, you know, or extra charges on top of that for administration or business costs, you know, but beyond the actual physical learning costs are something that people are only getting used to being rolled into or added on extra on top of their driving lesson cost.
And what kind of numbers are we talking about in terms of how many driving instructors are operating independently and how many would be going through the AA or BSM?
Well, Driving Instructors Association, my body is the largest representative body for driving trainers in the United Kingdom, and we've got over 10,000 members. So compared to the national franchises, we're a lot larger in terms of the numbers. AA, BSM have got anywhere between about 4,000 and 5,000 combined. That might be a little bit toppy. You'd have to get them to define that. But they have a good few thousand working for them. But the majority of instructors working in the UK, although these franchises look like big brands, the majority of instructors actually are independent driving schools.
The price of learning to drive is high, Carly, isn't it? So it would never have been fair for extra booking fees to be imposed. Do you have some kind of a rule or guidelines for your members that imposes some kind of a limit on the fee anyway?
We don't impose a limit. We're a representative body. So our job is to promote why investing in a decent amount of training with a decent instructor at a decent price is an investment. It's there to keep your child safe. So making sure your child is having the right amount of learning with a properly qualified approved driving instructor, you know, there is going to be a cost to that. And that's justifiably so. You know, we'll have parents paying out for a piano teacher and a professional football coach at costs that actually outstrip a driving trainer. And actually, it's a driver trainer that's going to keep your child safe on the road, not the piano teacher. No disrespect to musical teachers, but this is what our instructors are actually doing, keeping people safe on the road. But the average around the UK at the moment is around about that £35 to £40 an hour. That did increase slightly after COVID because demand has obviously increased exponentially for driving lessons. But, you know, we genuinely believe that's where it should be for the life-saving skill that a driver trainer is passing on to that pupil.
You're also a key stakeholder advisor to the Driving and Vehicle Standards Agency. So can we have a quick chat about the general state of the industry, Carly? Because, you know, we've all heard these terrible stories about the amount of time that people are waiting in some test centres to get a test. And we know that there's some very bad practice that has been uncovered with people queuing online to take the test slots and then flogging them on. What's going on?
Well, it's very interesting you ask me that, because hot off the press, Ruth Cadbury, who is the chair of the Transport Committee, has just sent me an email saying that she's written to ministers again on behalf of the Transport Committee, fundamentally saying they're not necessarily satisfied that DVSA is doing enough to tackle test waiting times. We're now more than 5 years on post-COVID, where the problems actually started with test supply, and we're now at 21.2 weeks as of January 2026 in terms of a national waiting time average for driving tests. Now, if you imagine immediately post-COVID, when you would have expected things to be at their most extreme in terms of waiting times, we were only looking at waiting times of 14 weeks. Despite successive strategies by DVSA and plans to deal with some of the issues around test waiting times, we've actually doubled the waiting time in many ways. For my money, I think there's been far too much concentration on the booking system is the problem, and the bots are the problem. The reality is not that. The reality is it's driving examiner supply. Getting enough people to be able to conduct tests to the front line has always been the problem. The booking system has been problematic, allowing third parties in there. But what I'm particularly unhappy about that DVSA have done in this whole debacle is include driving instructors in that bunch of third parties that they are saying were reselling tests. It is a tiny, tiny amount of people that were actually found in the driving instructor community to be involved in reselling tests, tiny. And DVSA have still not come back to me with that firm number updated of those who they found they were driving instructors, as opposed to just businesses making hay whilst the sun shined by sending their bots into the system and reselling tests.
Right, and presumably you're very happy to help get to the bottom of exactly who it is, anybody in your association who has indulged in bad practice.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking you're going to ask them not to be in the association anymore.
Yeah, we have our own rules of conduct, and also there's a procedure that DVSA has as a regulator called Fit and Proper. You can remove somebody for that, and the amount of removals they made don't stack up to the ADIs being a problem. They haven't confirmed the actual extent of the problem being ADIs. It is more so independent third parties. There were even pupils making bots during this crisis to go and find their own tests, because they're bright and they're young and they understand how to program bots.
Okay, so you need the government to actually be creating more testers in order to solve the problem.
Definitely. If they can recruit more examiners, they've had 19 successive recruitment campaigns to try and bring on new examiners. They're losing examiners out the back door who are existing examiners who are getting fed up with the testing scenario. People come into the system as new trainees and, quite frankly, probably get put off by the workload that's in front of them, the job itself. And retention in the training period alone is pretty poor. So, you know, there needs to be a focus on what can we do to attract, retain people, recruit them. And that was another thing that we discussed more than 2 years ago, nearly now, at the Transport Committee, was what can we do about that? Is raising the salaries of examiners a good methodology to keep them on board and attract new people? And that still hasn't been achieved either.
Thank you very much indeed for all of that insight. That's Carly Brookfield, who's CEO of the Driving Instructors Association, waiting patiently in order to drive down the slip road and join the dual carriageway of chat is Edmund King, president of the AA. Edmund King, very good afternoon. Thank you for listening to all of that. Can we go back to the beginning and talk about this fine that has been imposed on the AA of more than £4 million over these hidden driving lesson fees? Does the AA have £4 million ready and available to pay the fine? Well, what happened here?
I mean, firstly, they weren't hidden. What actually happened was that we inadvertently infringed consumer competition law, because our booking fee of £3 wasn't hidden. It was actually in the journey, but it was further down the journey before you check out. And under the CMA regulation, it should have been at the beginning of the journey. Now, you know, we weren't aware of that. We didn't do it on purpose. As soon as we were told about it, we changed it. So people always knew they were paying the fee. And in fact, 79% of our customers are repeat customers. So they may have booked 4 or 5 lessons, 10 lessons, and then they come back. And during that process, it's one click and the £3 booking fee is there. And the fee's there for a reason. I don't think Carly really understood our business model, because at the AA and BSM, we actually act as an agent for driving instructors who are self-employed and have a franchise. So all the money for the lesson goes directly to those instructors. So the booking fee is actually for the system that books them in, gets the time, does the marketing, deals with refunds, and all of those things that the AA does on their behalf. And the investigation wasn't about the booking fee. In fact, our booking fee of £3 is far less than most others of driving schools that I've just seen online. So it was more on the positioning, and we hold our hands up. We got it wrong. Someone missed it on the journey, but it was never done with intention. We would not do that. That's not what the AA is about. We champion on behalf of consumers, and we've done that for 120 years, and we continue to do it. I'm right. Talking to the minister next week about potholes. It was fuel prices last week. It was smart motorways before that, you know. So we made a mistake. We hold our hands up. We got it wrong. We've got a big fine to pay, which we'll have to pay, and then we move on.
OK. And we're always so delighted to have you on, Mr. King, to talk about all of those things that you've just mentioned. I suppose the thing that I'm automatically thinking is, if it's been such a genuine mistake and it's just in the wrong part of that customer journey, then why can't the Competitions and Markets Authority just accept that it was in the wrong place and fine you £4 million for
well,
it?
Well, indeed, that is a good question. You know, it is the law, they say, and the law says that the fee should be up front. I mean, it is interesting, though, because I spoke to...
Sorry, can I just get absolutely clear on this? So if I was the person who was booking the driving lesson, it would have been totally fine if, let's say, on the first or the second page when I'm making the booking, it had said, do you accept a £3 fee? That would have been fine.
Yeah.
But if I'd seen it
absolutely
right at end, then it would. Then that's the bit that isn't fine. But it would still have come before I pressed. Payment and put my card details in.
Yeah, I spoke to a couple of people last week who actually used the system, and during that period, and I said, "Were you aware there was a booking fee?" They said, "Absolutely, it was clear. It said £3." But you know, we accept the CMA says, and you know, and for transparency, I do agree. It would be much clearer if it was up front. And as soon as the CMA told us, we changed it. And so the fine, I mean, the fine is, it's massive. And the problem is that the driving school is actually a small subsidiary of ours that does not make much money. You know, it's franchises. But the fine is based on the global revenue of the AA. Now, obviously, most of our business is in breakdown, insurance, and other aspects. So for the driving school, a fine of $4.2 million is way over the top. And that's why we said we're disappointed. You know, we obviously have to accept the law. The law's the law. So we do accept it, and we've cooperated with the CMA. But that doesn't mean we're particularly happy about it. We're certainly not.
Do you think if you canvassed most of the people who had paid the £3 booking fee and explained exactly that to them, they would have thought that they were being included in something that was a law-breaking practice?
Let's put it this way. Out of 250,000 transactions with pupils over that period, we had 5 emails, 2 of which mentioned a booking fee. I think that puts into context. What people were more concerned about is what you were discussing before, the 5-month waiting time to get a test, the bots charging twice as much to get a test. These are the issues our pupils are very concerned about and issues that we've been campaigning on for a number of years. So, you know, in context of other things out there, other things that are going on in the world, I could name you quite a few that have far more adverse consequences than a £3 booking fee that wasn't mentioned up front. But we accept we got it wrong. The law's the law. We fixed it and we move on.
And the £4.2 million fine, that goes through the CMA, but that goes into the government's coffers. Yeah. Is it in any way hypothecated? Could it be put back into a system where the people who are waiting for a driving test for up to 5 months and have been scammed into paying £500 for it, they could expect a better deal in the future?
You've actually read our minds, Pete. That we had a discussion internally about that, and we would rather that money had gone into the pupils or even gone into potholes to sort out the problems for drivers rather than just going into a black hole in the Treasury. And we certainly discussed that internally, that you know, rather than an average of an £8 refund, we'd have rather seen some of that money going to the young drivers, because learning to drive is an expensive thing, and yet many people need it to get a step on the ladder, to get a job, to get mobility. So, yeah, but unfortunately, that's not the way the system works.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sure we'll get lots of feedback from our listeners about this. You heard from Edmund King, who's the president of the AA, and before that, Carly Brookfield, who's CEO of the Driving Instructors Association. Do you notice where a booking fee is in the journey that you might make? Because it's there in so many things. Sometimes if you're booking a ticket for a movie, or, you know, if you're booking some kind of removal service or something like that, there can be all kinds of different fees that appear in that journey. Do you notice whether it's at the beginning or the end?
I really don't, I'm afraid. I mean, I did think, I admired Mr. King's determination to refer to it as a journey with his AA hat on, because you're just filling a form in, aren't you? I never thought of it as a journey.
Well, you are.
But I now will think of it as one.
Yes, yeah. Quite a long and winding journey, yes, sometimes, often, isn't it?
What's this from David? My eldest daughter passed last summer. The cost was £125 for each two-hour driving lesson. Wow. And that's not the story. Good independent instructor, though, who managed to pass all three of my offspring. But I daren't think of the total cost over the five-plus years. I mean, it really does set you back, doesn't it? £125 for a two-hour lesson. Do you think that's a lot? I do.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, it's not a job that for the faint-hearted, is it? I do admire people who could even conceive of the possibility of being a driving instructor. What a way to earn your living. And Alan, don't worry, I'm not going to claim that Joanna Scanlon is from Liverpool. She isn't from Liverpool. She was born on the Wirral, as you point out. And that was then, as you also point out, in Cheshire. But Joanna Scanlon is our guest after 3:30 this afternoon. It's our sports guy, Vassos, after these messages at 23 minutes past three.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Download the Free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We were just talking, which you shouldn't do on radio. It's one of the fatal errors. Fee, have you ever wondered how the biggest stories actually make it onto the front pages of a newspaper?
I have very much wondered, Jane.
Next week, on April the 21st, you might get some answers to the many questions you've had on this issue over the years. We are opening the doors to the Times, or to the News Building, I should say, for our latest edition of Inside the Newsroom. Now, if you're lucky enough to be a Times subscriber, and I know that you are, Fee, you are invited. Tom Calver and Fraser Nelson are going to be digging into the UK's so-called migration demographic time bomb, and Jeremy Griffin will sit down with Shanti Das to take you behind the scenes of her explosive investigation into the criminal networks fueling visa fraud. Sounds very interesting. And it's April the 21st, so that is next Tuesday, isn't it? And if you'd like a ticket, head to thetimes.com/events. He's here. The faint whiff of deep heat heralds the arrival of Vassos Alexander. And we've got a good swim story today. Sorry.
Do you remember Steve Wright, the late Steve Wright
how
at Radio 2? He had his own studio in Radio 2 in what's now Wogan House.
Oh, yes.
And it absolutely stank of TCP constantly. And nobody knows why.
We know. Well, we know were there.
Why. So Steve Wright was very generous towards Jane and I. And he'd always ask us on if we had a new something or other that we were flogging. And
you make it sound so tawdry. Yeah.
And quite often he would share with us his ailments, which, bless him, he knew that he was a bit of a hypochondriac, and he would tell us about all of the different lotions and potions that he was taking and that he had. And actually, it was the smell of antiseptic that always really stayed
with me. It did remind me of Matron's Office a lot. And actually, the last time we saw him, he was very funny about the list of things that he had. He brought out a list, didn't he, really, of ailments he was suffering from. And Jane and I kind of talked him down from it.
He used to go to America. To buy special drugs that you couldn't get in the UK, didn't he?
Much missed. Right, let's talk swimming. And the son of the Olympian, the gold medalist David Wilkie, didn't follow in his father's footsteps as a swimmer, despite David Wilkie setting a record in the 200 metres breaststroke at the 1976 Summer Games. Can't believe it was so long ago. His name is Adam. He's quit his job and he's now preparing to take his first strokes next week, embarking on a mission to try to break his father's record. So, Vassos, over to you. This is a really intriguing one. Never heard of anything like this before. Let's go back to the summer of 76.
So, David Wilkie shatters the world record for the 200 metres breaststroke. The new mark that he sets is 2:15. It stands for many years. In fact, that mark, if you were to swim 2:15 in the men's 200 metres final at the British Championships last year, you would have finished inside the top six. So it is still a pretty amazing time. And this is his son, Adam. So we lost David Wilkie a couple of years ago to cancer. And as part of his grieving process, his son, Adam, has said, you know, just to honour my dad, I'm going to quit my job. And it was a proper big job at a big skincare company, and that job has been kept open for him if he wants, but he thinks his life now is going to go off in a different direction. They started sponsoring Ironman triathlons. He just sort of watched these semi-professional swimmers going at it, and he thought, do you know what, I would love to do this in memory of my dad. 2:15. So 2:15, 2 minutes and 15 seconds is the mark that he's aiming for. And he phoned Duncan Goodhue, who succeeded, well, not so succeeded, but in the next games, he became Britain's gold medalist in the breaststroke, who's also, we're talking about Steve Wright being a lovely man.
He's a nice man.
Duncan Goodhue is a hugely lovely man. I once phoned him up when I was trying to swim the Channel solo, and he's so nice. He'd never say, no chance, mate. But he sort of did to Adam Wilkie. He said, apparently there was a long pause on the phone, and Duncan said, it's going to hurt.
Well, I would imagine it would, because as Adam acknowledges, he's not a swimmer. And also, he's now in his, early 30s?
33.
So how is it remotely possible?
I mean, let's not pour too much cold water on, because it's a lovely thing to do. And his, his mum says it's the perfect way to honour your dad's memory. So great. He's trying to raise £215,000 for SportsAid, which is a charity close to his dad's heart. So lots of kids who get into sport early on have to quit because they can't afford to keep going, and SportsAid is a charity that lets them continue on their chosen path, which is great. So it's all for charity. He wants to do it to honour his dad. It's great. I don't know if you've seen this clip, but it's absolutely staggering. Adam Peaty, our current breaststroke king, he gives some club swimmers a race in a 50-metre pool, just one length of the pool, breaststroke. Yep. And he lets them all go. And he's standing on the blocks. And a couple of seconds go past. And another couple of seconds. And they're absolutely going for it and going for it and going for it in the pool. And then 5 seconds go past and he's still... 10 full seconds go past in a 50-metre race.
Right.
Adam Peaty dives in, completely eats up the water. He comes second. He only just fails to win that race against club swimmers. And actually, that was David Wilkie's thing, Duncan Goodhue, when he died, gave a lovely eulogy saying he might be Britain's greatest ever swimmer. And that's what he used to do. He used to eat up the water on the last lap. And you knew he was coming. And invariably he'd catch you. That's what Adam Peaty did to these club swimmers. So, look, it's a lovely story. And let's hope he can do it.
Yeah, there's a nice little detail in a piece by Craig Lord, which is on thetimes.com right now, about Adam's dad actually thinking about making a comeback at around the age that Adam is now.
Exactly the age of 33. But back then, you had to be... I mean, it's when Torvill and Dean did it as well. They were amateurs, and then they became professionals, and they wanted to become amateurs again, and it didn't quite work out for them, did it, when they came back and tried to do that on ice dancing. And it's the same... apparently he did think about a return to competitive swimming, because he retired at 22, a month after winning that gold medal in the 1976 Olympics, which is very, very young for a swimmer to retire. You're sort of thinking about your 5 years from your pomp at 22. So, yeah, he thought about it at 33, never quite happened to him. But it's nice poetry that Adam, his son, is 33 when he's going to try and do this.
Lovely to have you on, Vassos. We were going to talk about wasting time in football, but we've run out of time.
We spent too long taking that corner.
Trust me, though, they're all at it. Right. What's next, V?
We'll be joined by the actress Joanna Scanlon to hear more about her new Channel 5 thriller, Miss Call. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Keir Starmer's insisted he would not be dragged into the Iran war despite pressure from the US. It's after President Trump said the UK's trade deal could always be changed. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister's rejected an offer from Kemi Badenoch to work together to find welfare savings to fund defence after criticism this week from a former NATO boss. Ex-Labour Defence Secretary Lord Robertson claimed national security's in peril, awaiting a 10-year defence plan to be signed off. The Prime Minister disagreed, insisting defence spending will rise each year. He also attacked the Conservatives' defence spending record.
When they came into office, defence spending was 2.5%. Yes. When they left, it was 2.3. When they came into office, the army was 100,000. When they left office, 72,000. She said at the weekend, our defence is the weakest for 400 years. That is what they left behind.
Elsewhere, a court has heard a film student was punched, kicked and stamped on by up to seven men before being fatally stabbed in London. 21-year-old Finbar Sullivan died at Primrose Hill last Tuesday. A court has heard a film and two men have been handed the first bans for trying to enter a football match in England and Wales without a ticket. They won't be allowed to go to a game for 3 years after being caught during last month's EFL Cup final. Apologies for that. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
There is a land steeped in ancient history, myth and legend, where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. This spring, start your own story in Scotland. From wild mountain ranges to bustling cities, witness Scotland bloom into life this spring. Explore its dramatic landscapes and uncover our ancient Celtic roots. Experience vast lochs, majestic glens and lofty mountains, all easily accessible from our many vibrant cities and towns. Scotland is the perfect place to find yourself. Whether you're looking for scenic hikes or a stay in a cosy cottage, there's something for every type of traveller in Scotland. And with an exciting range of festivals and sporting and cultural events to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
The To-Do List. Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Our guest this afternoon is Joanna Scanlon, who's graced many a brilliant TV show, The Thick of It, No Offence, and most recently, Sally Wainwright's big hit about a midlife menopausal band, Riot Women. She was also one of the writers of Getting On, the brilliantly bleak sitcom about an NHS geriatric ward. And this week, she is starring in Channel 5's thriller Missed Call, playing Sarah, a woman determined to find out what's happened to her teenage daughter, who's gone AWOL on a French exchange trip. Somehow, Joanna's also found time to narrate Mercy. This is an Audible original story written by the journalist Peter Bradshaw. And Joanna is back in the world here of the NHS.
It's a sort of monologue. I mean, the Audible version, it does have some other, some of the male characters do make their appearance, but essentially it's a monologue. It's a woman who is retiring from her profession as a nurse. She's been in the job for 40 years or whatever. And it starts off very benignly. I think people think of nurses as benign figures. I mean, I know there are obviously exceptions and well-known exceptions, both fictional and in reality. But that sense of the benign is there at the beginning. And then as we slowly unpack, we realise that underneath this perfectly ordinary nurse, there is a raging fury about the way in which she's been treated, both within the hierarchies of the medical system, but also by men, parents, and those kind of guys who are around you when you're a teenager, you know, friends of friends of. And I think, and it all bubbles up. And yes, there's an element of mystery about it, but it's also, I think, very relatable. I think as you listen, or at least as I was unpacking it as a performer, I started to get that sense where you go, oh, do you know what, actually, when that happened, blah, 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 you know, the Me Too element of it all.
Yeah, well, when you get a job like that, it's quite unusual, isn't it? A monologue. Mm. There's something curiously old-fashioned about it, but it must be a blissful thing to do as an actor.
Well, Peter had written it, I think, almost for his own delight. He's a wonderful, you know, we know he's, as you say, a wonderful journalist, but he's also a great writer of fiction. He's written novels and short stories and so on. And I think he wrote it initially as a sort of, it almost poured out of him. And then he came to me and said, well, what should we, you know, would you be interested in doing something with it? So we did a little theatre performance of it a couple of years ago for a festival called Croydon Nights, which is a kind of avant-garde theatre festival in Croydon area. And they really supported it. And we kind of thought, well, this is, there's something in this. It's something there. And he took it to Audible. And Audible have become quite interesting in terms of what they want to do. It's very, the way they describe themselves is cinematic audio. And I think, as opposed to what we think of as old-fashioned radio drama, it's got a sense of scale to it on an audio level.
It's incredibly glossy. And I've got to say, if someone had told me 10 years ago you'll spend quite a lot of your leisure time listening to books, I'd have said, you must be bloody joking. But actually, I love listening to books, whether I'm on the tube or the bus or whatever it is, or just pottering at home.
Absolutely, so do I. I'm addicted.
It is just really, really extraordinary. In a world of so much high-octane entertainment, we need to enjoy the fact that so many of us just love the spoken word and the written word.
And it's books, but it's also these Audible originals.
Yeah.
So they're kind of commissioning and getting quite interesting writers or adaptations into dramas. And I don't want to suggest that the BBC wasn't able to exploit that to the same extent, but they are able to put more money in. And I think you can, you know, hear it in your ears that it's got support behind it and the quality of what they do in Audible terms.
A couple of coconut shells pretending to be a horse.
And as you know, in this case too, the Mercy is quite an unusual. I don't think we would have got that through anywhere else. It's quite an unusual angle,
you know?
It's
dark, but also very funny. And I've done a bit of work in the NHS over the years, and it has nailed NHS jargon and hierarchy because they are hugely significant. And there's a management HR figure who pops up in the life of the nurse.
Yes.
All of that is absolutely spot on.
Yeah, well, I did. We wrote with Joe Brand and Vicky Pepperdine, wrote Getting On, how long ago now? A long time.
I've got it written down here somewhere. That was one of my favourite programmes of all time, genuinely.
Thank you.
Because it was about, well, for anyone who hasn't seen Getting On, it's set on a geriatric ward of an NHS hospital. Yes. Now, you are, I can't remember the name of your character, what were you called?
Den Flickster.
Yes, Den Flickster. You weren't very good, were you?
Oh, do you know what? I think you're casting aspersions, because she was good enough. She knew exactly where the point was where she wouldn't get fired, but doing no more than that.
Right. Well, you know, that's not a bad way to live if you can get away with it.
There's an argument for that, yeah.
And Vicky Pepperdine's character was obsessed with the Bristol stool chart.
Yeah, well, she was an authoritarian, old-fashioned consultant who really thought everyone was there just to do her bidding. And so, you know, I think within a hierarchy, people are responding to each other. Mm. So Den character is doing just enough, partly because she dislikes so much the consultant's leadership style. You know, it's changing. The NHS is not... We wrote that a long time ago. It is really not like that anymore.
I've had recent experience of brilliant, brilliant care for my parents in the NHS, so I don't want to knock it at all. I really don't.
No, no, no. My best friend is... He's in the trauma ward at King's College Hospital.
Right.
And he is a nurse. And so I know the differences between what was going on in sort of 2010 when we wrote that and what's going on now. And I actually did some work recently for the medical school at Bangor University, partly about communications. And that's because they are developing systems and ways to make sure that multidisciplinary teams are working in a more kind of, you know, horizontal instead of vertical fashion.
Oh, that's interesting. So, and was that because of what you'd done in getting on that you were asked to do that?
Well, that arose, you know, tell me to stop here because we could get into the weeds of this. But I did a film called Joy a few years ago, which was about the development of IVF. And it was the story.
Oh, yes, I saw it.
Do you remember it? Yes, so it's Patrick Steptoe and Robert Edwards were the two physicians, doctors, medics, and there was a nurse involved, Jean Purdy. And Jean died young. Steptoe had died also by the point that Robert Edwards was awarded a Nobel Prize. And that is just at the end of the film. I mean, it's a wonderful film, actually.
It is a good film.
How necessary it was to have a woman as part of a very important team, but also a nurse rather than a doctor, because the nurse needed to basically have the human communication abilities that would get women's interest or potential mothers' interest in being part of the research programme. Robert Edwards was at Bangor University himself as a student, and so the university is very keen to honour that memory, and I went to give a Q&A to the new medical school there about him and his work. And we showed the film at the same time. And Netflix very, very kindly allowed us to show a film because they normally won't.
No, they don't, yeah.
But they did on this occasion for educational purposes.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. That's not in the weeds at all. That's riveting. Because that was a really good film. And again, women do sometimes get lost in the mix of these incredible stories and discoveries, don't they?
Yeah, and Robert Edwards, he spent his life making sure that her name was still retained on the building and in the programme. I mean, you can't get a posthumous Nobel Prize. But had she not died so sadly at 39, she would be a Nobel Prize winner.
Right. Gosh, that's really significant.
Mm.
Did you do science at university? Are you a scientist? No.
Not at all. I did history.
Right. Yeah. What's your favourite period?
19th century social history. Yeah. I did mainly the period between sort of Victoria's reign starting 1813, whatever, through to her death.
And why did that appeal to you?
Well, we had some very good programmes of study. I mean, this is so long ago now. It's all, you know, it's been superseded. It's history itself, yes, exactly. But we had a lot of courses that were around... Well, firstly, we did a course on Victoria's diaries, which Daisy Goodwin was also on the same course as me at the same time. And she has very sensibly gone back to that
course. Tell you what, course. She made a few quid.
And get it out of the trunk and has certainly made some use of it. So we did her diaries, which, of course, are fascinating. I think Daisy's talking at the moment about having written some more around Victoria's diaries, which are... Anybody who wants a good read, go back to them because they're amazing. Mm. But we also looked a lot at a different course to do with deviancy in society in the 19th century and how that was defined and how it became something that was part of the Victorian values that was mentioned in the 80s about what is right and what is wrong, what is moral and what is not, and the place of women in that. Although the course wasn't about the place of women, but inevitably you're looking at the position of women in society. And I just read The Five, where I'm a bit late to the party.
Oh, by Hallie Reubenhold. Yeah.
It is absolutely the most gripping book I have read in a long time.
And that is about the victims of the so-called... I hate those stupid nicknames for serial killers, but...
Yes, the Whitehall murders, let's call them.
Yeah,
yeah. Jack the Ripper, as is sensationalised at the time and still today.
Yeah.
But the book there is the life of women writ large, and you really see how the economic structures, social structures, patriarchal structures made it extremely difficult for women to escape out of a downward spiral. I mean, she's done extraordinary research through, it must be from workhouse documents, to find out literally what a woman, these women who were seen to be nobodies at the time, and still actually similarly not thought of as significant, but she's traced their day-to-day lives, their marriages, their deaths, and everything in between. It's just the most, I mean, riveting book. So it's my history course, I got very interested in that sort of, in underworlds, and did a few other books that we did which were more sort of oral histories that had been written into a book. There's a guy called Raphael Samuel who was doing a lot of that at Ruskin College at the time. I started to sort of turn those into plays and ended up doing quite a lot of theatre out of that work.
But you didn't initially leave university and go into acting, did you? It didn't happen that quickly for you?
No. Well, I was planning to. And then I was heartbroken, actually, just after I left university. Got into a terrible depression. I mean, sort of, I think a lot of people, I think the years between sort of graduation, if you've gone to university, and even possibly if you haven't, that sort of aged about 20, 21, through to 30.
Oh, it's tough.
Really tough. And you're supposed to know it all and know what you're doing, and you don't, and most people don't. It's the end of education. It's the end of when people have told you what to do and where to go next. And so I had a massive, massive collapse. Ended up working in my local community theatre, because I was always going to be, you know, acting or doing something to do with theatre. Ended up working in my local community theatre in Rotherhithe, and then living on a council estate, working in all sorts of interesting projects. And that took me into teaching, because I could not get a job as an actor. I couldn't work it all out. I didn't have an equity card, and in those days you needed one. I could not work out how to get started. And all my friends, because I was, you know, at Cambridge University, where there is a massive leg up, that is true, it is a privileged starting point, they were all running ahead. And I was sort of thinking, I really don't know what to do here. I don't know how to start. How did that happen? So I got into teaching. I ended up at Montford University as a lecturer for 5 years, teaching drama and working actually some of those texts. We were just talking about those old history documents, turning them into productions and adaptations. And I loved all that, and it was wonderful. But I suddenly had quite a dramatic breakdown. I call it a breakdown. At the time, it was diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't walk. I couldn't do anything. And I was off work for a year. And in that year, I went to see a consultant at the hospital who was a physician. He was a diagnostician. He wasn't a, back to hospitals, he wasn't a psychological guy at all. And he said, ask me a couple of questions, having done all the tests. One of them was, what do you dream about? And the other was there ever a job that you wanted to do that you're not doing? I was 29. And I said, yes, I wanted to be an actress. And he said, okay, well, if you don't go back to that, if you don't go back to being an actor, I think you'll be ill for the rest of your life.
Oh, wow. Oh, how did you react to that?
I felt like somebody had punched me in the middle of my chest.
Because you knew they were right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I knew he was right. And it was so embarrassing, Jane. It was so embarrassing to then at 29 say, actually, you know, wait for me. I'd like to join the party. I mean, I'm actually like feeling tingles at the memory of the humiliation.
Okay, well, I mean, people will be, I think, I hope, it's funny enough, this subject has been something we've been talking about on the podcast the last couple of days, about people who sometimes feel left behind, particularly in their 30s, when it feels like everybody else is racing ahead and achieving all those things you're meant to achieve. So I hope people are heartened by it, not least because you've had such success, I'm going to say it, relatively late in life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
I mean, Riot Women was a show that just meant such a lot to so many people. Mm. And you learnt the piano for that, didn't you?
Did, yeah.
And why is it that shows like that just, I don't know, it was like another punch in the gut for the female audience, I think, because so many of us watched it and recognised at least a part of ourselves in it.
Yeah, I think the show was sort of written by and intended to be for what I will call our age group. Yes, I hate the expression of a certain age.
Forget
don't
that,
you?
Yeah,
I loathe that. But you know that's what it was intended for. And what's been really interesting to me is that gradually, as it sat there on iPlayer, I've had younger and younger and younger people coming up to me, and now a lot of young men coming up to me and saying, oh, I'm a massive Riot Woman fan. And I think that's interesting because I think people see, not only do, you know, my age group relate to it as an experience, but I think you see what's happened to your mum, your relatives, and what could happen to you as well. I think it's hugely relatable on a much wider social level than it was originally thought.
Yeah, I think that's right. Actually, oddly enough, it makes me think of Mercy a bit, because that's all just about the idea that women were sort of put on this earth to facilitate the lives of others, and that we don't mind at all wiping bottoms and things like that, because, hey, you know, that's what we're here for. But actually, that's a profession in itself, which most people are not remotely suited to.
No, absolutely.
I mean, it's something that should be taken seriously and certainly paid properly.
I think there is a new school, what to me a new school of thought, which is that actually our job as women is not to enable men's crises to end up in a good place. That's not what we have to do. And I think in my head, that somewhere I believe that is my job, to make sure that it doesn't all go wrong for everybody else. And I don't know whether that's nature nurture or what, but I've heard it expressed recently quite on quite a few places, like, it's not your job to sort that out. And I go, isn't it? That's what it was.
Which brings us to Channel 5. and to your drama, which is on all week. You're here all week. It's called Missed Call.
Yes.
Now, I have to say, it's every parent's nightmare. The phone call that you get in the middle of the night from a member of the family, offspring, and you call back because you don't initially grab the phone and they don't reply when you call back. And this is at the root of this. I mean, I watched the first episode and, yeah, it's... I want to know that the conclusion is not too disturbing. I know you can't tell
us. I can't tell you that. I can't promise that. And that's partly because I think it is very well plotted. Very, very well plotted.
Yeah.
And almost anything I said now would lead people in all sorts of false directions.
Well, you play the mum who, I have to say, you get very quickly from your home in England to the setting in a beautiful part of France. I mean, quite a bit of expense is spared in showing us your journey.
Yes, exactly.
you pack your case and suddenly you're getting off a bus in France.
Yeah.
But hey, pace is everything in drama. Does look a beautiful place. It really does.
It was absolutely gorgeous. Southwest France near Montpellier. Right. The villages, medieval villages, beautiful seaside resorts. Yeah. I mean, lovely. And just very, very hot and with a lot of mosquitoes.
Can I just say, it does look hot. Was it genuinely filmed in the summer?
Yeah, I'm afraid to tell you that our director collapsed. I mean, it was 40 degrees. I mean, it was really, really hot.
Right, because sometimes, it's not just Channel 5, but I do watch dramas that are meant to be set in the summer where everyone's, you know, you can see them shivering.
Yes.
They're by
a
pool, but yeah, it's clearly about 8 degrees.
Yes, no, we had the real deal, but we too much of it, you know. One of the actors also struggled with it. I mean, I struggled with it. I'm not a sweater.
I'll always remember that about you. Lovely.
I don't even perspire.
Don't you?
No. I mean, it takes a hell of a lot to get a bead of sweat on my forehead. But I was standing there having to get my costume changed over and again, because you're standing as if you're in a river. It was really, really hot.
Okay, so that's Missed Call. It's on Channel 5. And I've got to say, if you watched episode 1, as I have, you will want to know what happens. Your boyfriend in this is played by Rupert Graves, and I simply don't trust him.
Oh, you should, because...
Oh, well, I don't.
If it's Rupert Graves, you should definitely trust him. If it's the man Jason, the character, then perhaps not. But Rupert is just absolutely gold, and I loved working with him. I've admired him forever, so it was an absolute delight for me.
Okay, now I understand that you're in, there's going to be a version of The Party, Elizabeth Day's novel, and there's been a sequel to The Party as well, which came out, which I loved. I absolutely loved both those books. Which character do you play?
Martin, I think the main character's called, and it's his, I play his mother. Well, I don't know if this is a spoiler, but I would say I'm one of the few characters with any moral compass.
Yes, well, Martin's led astray by a posho, isn't he?
He is, in the party.
I mean, you've got to be wary of that in life.
And his own ambition.
And that too.
Yeah.
And when is that coming out?
I think that's the autumn schedules.
Okay, wow. You're everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, well, thank you. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, but you'd have taken this. In that, when you think back to that encounter with that doctor, one who wasn't a psychologist but said something very powerful, you'd take all this, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I love working. I love acting. And I used to, when I first started out and I started as an actress and going to job interviews and so on, auditions, I thought, any day I act, including an audition, it's a plus. It's a good day.
So when you are...
I just love doing it.
...sweating your cobblers off in the south of France, you're thinking, I could be lecturing in Leicester.
Yeah, I could be lecturing in Leicester. I mean, I'm very happy to do that as well. But I think I have to accept that I am the most happy and the most contented in life between action and cut. That is just like who I am.
She's happy in her work and we enjoy watching her and hearing her. That's Joanna Scanlon. Mercy, the Audible original story by Peter Bradshaw, is available now. Missed calls on Channel 5 tonight.
Yeah, don't ask Jane for a review of it. I was looking forward to watching it, but I know something now that's completely ruined it for me. Sorry. I'm having a huff.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon. Opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, that is it from us for today. We'll be back tomorrow from 2. Our producer was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Thank you for so many messages. So much love for Joanna Scanlon. Up next, John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says the US is really war against Iran is a mistake, and she's not convinced the conflict's made the world a safer place. And the Prime Minister insists he won't be dragged into the war, despite pressure from the United States. And coming up, Is it true we can finance our defences without making cuts elsewhere? I'll get some clarity on the numbers and whether we are pledging enough to cover even the basics. And considering a battle has just been won entirely by robots on the Ukrainian battlefield, are we confident we're investing money in the right technology? A former advisor to President Zelensky is going to be here talking to me live. We'll be talking about where we need to focus our funding. And Wes Streeting, the health secretary, unveils his new female health strategy. I'll talk to a woman who was told by doctors not to worry before finding out she'd suffered a heart attack.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Chancellor Rachel Reeves has said the US-Israeli war against Iran is a mistake and that she's not convinced that this conflict has made the world a safer place. The Chancellor's in Washington with her counterparts from 10 other countries. Their joint statement says the war has caused unacceptable loss of life and significant disruption to the global economy. It's called for a swift and lasting negotiated resolution to the conflict and a return to free and safe transit through the Strait of Hormuz. Ms. Reeves is set to meet US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent after he said a small bit of economic pain caused by the war was worth it to prevent Tehran getting a nuclear weapon. During Prime Minister's questions, Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey suggested this month's state visit to America should be put on hold.
Surely the Prime Minister can't send our king to meet a man who treats our country like a mafia boss running a protection racket.
The monarchy is an important reminder of the long-standing bonds and enduring relationship between our two countries.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister failed to answer Kemi Badenoch when she asked when a review on defence spending promised for the autumn would eventually be published after months of delay. It's after former Labour Minister and NATO Secretary-General Lord Robertson claimed the PM had a corrosive complacency to defence and was spending too much on welfare. The Prime Minister rejected that claim and turned the question back on the Conservatives.
When they came into office, defence spending was 2.5%. Yes. When they left, it was 2.3%. Yes. When they came into office, the army was 100,000. When they left office, 72,000. She said at the weekend, our defence is the weakest for 400 years. That is what they left behind.
Elsewhere, a manhunt is underway after an attempted arson attack on a synagogue in Finchley. Two suspects threw bottles suspected to contain petrol and a brick at the Finchley Reform Synagogue in North London in the early hours of this morning. Specialist detectives from counter-terrorism are supporting the Met Police detectives in the investigation, which is being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime. A court has heard a film student was punched, kicked and stamped on by up to seven men before being fatally stabbed in London. 21-year-old Finbar Sullivan died at Primrose Hill last Tuesday. Four men have been remanded in custody in connection with his death. Two men have been handed the first bans of trying to enter a football match in England and Wales without a ticket. They won't be allowed to go to a game for 3 years after being caught during last month's EFL Cup final at Wembley. And one in 10 BBC staff are being told their jobs are being cut this afternoon. It's part of a £600 million cost-cutting plan announced in February. The BBC is to cut as many as 2,000 jobs in the biggest downsizing of the public service broadcaster in 15 years. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for your company. When will Keir Starmer answer the question? The PM and his senior team, the Chancellor, the Defence Secretary, they're wearing something like the haunted look of a hunted species, chased by a pack of military commanders and ex-commanders, by worried security experts, by those who see the weakness of Britain's defences in the face of the threat from Vladimir Putin, which is pretty much everyone, and all of them waiting to know when will the government announce a plan to make our military fit for purpose. Now, earlier this afternoon, the Conservative opposition led the attack, conveniently forgetting the years in which past Tory governments watched UK armed forces wasting away. But fixing it is Starmer's job and his government's job now, and saying again and again that they're on the case, that they're spending more than ever, and that we'll get details of the long-delayed spending plan soon isn't cutting it. Not with the former Labour Defence Secretary and NATO Secretary-General, Lord Robertson, who's accusing him of corrosive complacency. And now Robertson's fellow author of the Strategic Defence Review, Fiona Hill, accusing the government of a bizarre lack of urgency. And that was the Times reporting the Chancellor's planning a limited increase in defence spending of £10 billion over 4 years, far short of even the £28 billion needed just to pay for existing plans, let alone the big increases that are said to be needed. So today on Drive, I'm going to be asking if it's possible, as the Treasury Minister seemed to suggest on Times Radio earlier, to find the billions needed for defence without cutting spending on welfare, say, to have our cake and eat it. Really? I'm going to be talking live in a moment to defence and strategic experts on the subject. And we certainly need to find a way to make the defence budget go further, either way, to get more bang for our buck, if you'll forgive the pun. Ukraine has just won its first battle with Russian fighting with a force made up entirely of drones and robots. It's an astonishing glimpse of the future. And I'll be talking live to President Zelensky's former advisor and a military expert in Ukraine. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, today's Times reports that Chancellor Rachel Reeves is planning to increase defence spending by less than £10 billion over the next 4 years. And this, as I say, is after Lord Robertson, the former Secretary-General of NATO, was saying much more needs to be done, that there's corrosive complacency at the top of government. So let's first of all welcome Matthew Saville, who's a Director of Military Sciences at the security think tank RUSI. Hello to you, Matthew.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you here. So now we see Fiona Hill adding her voice to Lord Robertson and that parade of British admirals and generals accusing the government of complacency and delay. What do you make of all of this? Is this about the Prime Minister being shy of taking what are admittedly very tough decisions to fund defence?
It's almost certainly part of that. I mean, that is all three lead reviewers for the Strategic Defence Review, because there's also Richard Barons, who have been now publicly very critical of the pace of implementation. It is unfortunately a slight reflection of some of the compromises in the Strategic Defence Review, which for the most part avoided setting out a detailed force structure or targets or public costings for what was involved in it. And you can imagine that that was in part because they wanted to give the government some flexibility about actually how it implemented it. But that's why there's so much pressure on the defence investment plan to set out the actual funding profile. So there's a bit of politics in here. There's a little bit of shifting the emphasis onto the government. And then we can get into what is it that they have or haven't done in terms of defence funding and what's required.
Right. So can we get down to some of the facts which are most relevant here? There was lots of a political verbiage thrown back and forwards across the House of Commons today. But I'd like to ask you just how deep a financial hole we are in when it comes to defence spending. The Prime Minister and his ministers, as you know, they keep pointing